That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. My guest today, Lindsay Whalen of the Minnesota Lynx. You may have seen right around Super Bowl, a couple videos we posted on ESPNW of Lindsay showing me around Minneapolis, some of the coolest stuff to see and do. We had a blast drinking and eating our way through Minneapolis, so you can check it out on ESPNW.com. I think if you just Google Sarah Spain and Lindsay Whalen, you'll get it. But I had a lot of fun with her that day, so I thought it'd be fun to have her on the pod. She has won everything under the sun, WNBA championships. She's a multi-time all-star Olympic medalist. She's won a Turkish Cup, a Euro Cup, all-time playoffs assist leader for the WNBA. So she's basically a badass baller. And it was really cool walking around Minneapolis and seeing how big her fan base is and how much the Lynx are respected and treated like the ballers that they are in that town. I think it would be awesome to see that spread to other cities. And that comes with the success that she's had, of course, and that they've had. So I'm excited to chat with her and excited for you guys to listen to it. I also, you know, coming into the pod today, I was thinking, I just came off of a luncheon today for this charity group, Embark, that I work with, that is a part of the curriculum during the day for, I think we're at almost 20 schools now in the Chicago area. And it replaces the class and offers up opportunities for kids at underserved schools to have different opportunities around the city, whether it's going to a coding place and learning about coding, or going to a high-end restaurant, or working in a restaurant for a day, going to a technology company, learning how to do their SATs or fill out their college applications, all sorts of different practical and cultural opportunities and experiences for kids that in some circumstances live 2 miles from Lake Michigan and they've never seen it. There's a teacher that works with Embark that had a fruit salad, and one of their high schoolers couldn't identify a strawberry, had not seen fresh fruit, had not been around it. They live in food deserts. And so it's a really awesome program. And I was at the luncheon today, and it was probably about 250 kids. And throughout the entire afternoon of different people getting up and speaking and engaging, they were so quiet and so attentive. And these are high school kids, man, like the worst of the worst, in my opinion. Maybe replaced only by toddlers in terms of you know, not being that interested in who is engaged with them and talking to them. And they were so good. And on Saturday, I was at this like charity gala event full of adults. Now, granted, there was alcohol involved. So that is one factor that, you know, certainly contributes to crass behavior and rudeness. But it was a charity event for a church school. And even as the priest was up there talking, people were blabbing away, talking right through him. And even when he would ask the group to pray, it would take like 10 seconds to trickle to the back where the people had been talking straight through everybody. And it was such an interesting dynamic for me in the span of a couple days to go from this huge room of adults that couldn't be bothered to be quiet for like 10 minutes to hear about the cause they were there supporting, next to this group of a couple hundred high school kids that were just rapt attention and really respectful. And if you are one of those people that goes to events and talks through the speakers, you are the worst. You probably don't even know it. You probably are listening to this and you're like, I would never do that. That's terrible. Well, think about that next time, because you probably are and you're probably doing it and it's terrible. And that is my PSA for the day. And I had to share, because I think my husband had to sit next to me and be like, deep breaths at the gala on Saturday, because I just don't get it. It's so disrespectful. And actually, as someone who's been on the mic emceeing or doing the auctions for stuff like that, it really stinks wasting people's time having to stop and pause and ask everyone to be quiet and pay attention and give respect to the people that are there for whatever cause they're supporting. So props to the Embark kids today. Embark kids, you guys rock. And if you're out there and you're someone that talks through stuff like that, or your friends are and you don't tell them to shut the heck up, then get better. Be better. Or as my buddy on my show, Spain and Fitz, Jason Fitz, said his buddy taught him, don't be that guy. So think about that next time. And now, check out my awesome interview with Lindsay Whalen.
That's what she said.
A reunion of sorts with Lindsay Whalen. As I mentioned in the intro, we were hanging out in Minnesota lately. And now I want to dig for a little more info on Lindsay, get a little deeper into the conversation. So happy to have her here on the pod. As I mentioned, 4-time WNBA champion, 5-time WNBA All-Star, 2-time Olympic gold medalist. She's pretty much won it all. Also the top 20 players of all time for the first 20 seasons of the WNBA. Thanks for making some time, Lindsay. I know this is your off season, so you got a little bit more free time right now.
Yeah, I do. Thanks for having me. It's definitely nice to have a little more time and whatnot. I got to thinking back a couple weeks ago, or whenever it was, maybe it was longer than that, the first Juicy Lucy that I had. I've got the hat
yes.
that they gave me still, Matt's from
nice.
Matt's Bar. So that was, that was a solid effort that we did that day. That was some serious eating and drinking we did. I think we did well. Did you make your flight back to Chicago?
Full sprint. Full sprint. I looked at my, I'm not even exaggerating.
Time?
Yeah, I looked at my phone afterwards because it has those like that health app that'll tell you how many steps you've taken or how far you've gone. And when I returned the rental car, I was like, all right, I'm just barely going to make it because there were zero flights out after mine. That was it.
Yeah.
So there was, it was not busy. And I was like, I'm going to make it because the rental car was really close. Okay. But it was really close to arrivals, not departures. So I had to sprint like the full length of a full parking garage, then get on a tram, and I had to wait 8 minutes for the tram to arrive. So I'm just sitting there like tapping my foot like,
oh my God.
Then full sprint
anxiety.
Through security. I was the only person in security. Then sprint to my gate. So all in all, it was like a mile and a half with like these giant snow boots on, carrying my two bags. Like it was just hot mess.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, when you left, because I was thinking, because the last spot took a while because they were trying to get like the perfect shot or whatever. Or I don't know, like the camera crew was trying to figure it out, so we were a little delayed. And it was our last spot, and we've been going hard pretty much all day. So by that point, everybody was just kind of ready to wrap it up. And then you had this flight, and I was like, oh man, that'd be just the worst. Just after all this whole day, then you missed your flight home. So
yes,
glad to hear you made it.
It was aggressive. It was aggressive. And then I had to spend the next like 2 days recovering from all the food and booze. But, I wanted to have you on because, you know, I liked kind of hearing some of your story that day, but I'd love to talk a little more. And on this pod, it's a lot about like process and how people kind of grew up and became who they are. So let's start back in Hutchinson, Minnesota, which is where you grew up. When you were a kid, were you always an athlete, like super active right from the start?
Yeah, I was definitely always into sports and into everything. I think me and my dad would watch the Vikings games, and then at halftime we'd go out and run routes, and I would be Anthony Carter. I was always the receiver, and he would just, you know, we'd work on like crossing pattern and post pattern and all that. And then I actually played hockey first before basketball, and I think I was probably five when my parents took me and signed me up for hockey, and I was the only girl on the team or in Hutchinson for that matter on the, you know, playing in the boys hockey league. So, I think that they just had to keep me busy because I had so many other younger brothers and sisters that I just was like outside playing all the time. And we do all the neighborhood games, you know, we play whatever season it was, that's kind of what we played. And so we'd play hockey in the winter. We'd play football in the fall. We threw in some soccer in the summer. So, yeah, we kind of played everything. And, we'd play basketball even in the winter. We'd go through our stretches, just whatever people were feeling like we'd play. So, yeah, I was active both, like, in the neighborhood and then in school and playing pretty much everything I could play. I would be playing, and I was definitely pretty competitive right from the start.
So you're the oldest of your siblings?
Yeah, I have four younger brothers and sisters. So my brother, who's the youngest, is 23, and I'm 35. So there's 12 years difference between us. And then my sister, she's 31. My brother's 29. And then I have another sister who's 25. So, yeah,
so
big family.
Do you think that if you had an older brother, he would have been the one that got that attention from dad running routes? Or do you think your dad's was always, even when you were little, pretty open-minded about, like, he was going to have his girls be just as athletic as his boys?
Yeah, I mean, when I think back at it now, this is pretty, like, you know, my parents had me in boys hockey. That was, you know,
pretty progressive, yeah.
Yeah, really, really progressive, and I'm really thankful to them for, like, not, you know, because there was definitely a lot of parents that were like, oh, she can't skate, or, like, she can't play. Why is she playing with the boys? And my mom took me the first day and was like, listen, she wants to play hockey. So that's all she talks about is hockey and the North Star. So she's playing hockey, you know. And then my dad was big in hockey at that time, too. Like, he was a goalie growing up. So I think he eventually coached me 1 year. But at the time, he was, like, the goalie's coach for the hockey team. So, yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, he just, I don't know, he loves sports. And that was our connection. That's always been our big connection, me and my dad. is just, you know, sports and talking the game. And he always still, he has a really, like, level head and a really calm mindset of everything. So, you know, like last year when we lost game four in the finals, we lost game three. So our backs were against the wall game four of the finals. I called him like every day leading up, and he always had like good stuff to say. He calmed me down, got me in the right mindset for the game. And he's done that for my whole life and really my whole career. So both my parents have been, you know, huge influences and great role models for me, but they've each had, you know, I guess like different, you know, they have different points. They have different strengths. So, but they were back then, that was 1987, I was the only girl playing, and they just took me in there and got me to play. So, yeah, I'm very thankful that they were that forward thinking.
Because of your start out in hockey, you weren't as focused on basketball. In fact, it wasn't until midway through high school, right, that you were like, oh, maybe I'm actually kind of good at this.
Yeah, I mean, I started playing on the team in like sixth grade. My best friend was on the basketball team, and that's where my parents, so I played hockey all these years. And then before it was, there was checking, they were like, you probably shouldn't play anymore because the boys were just going to, you know, getting checked in the boards and stuff was going to, you know, probably lead to some injuries and whatnot. So they weren't, you know, too big on that. But then also there was no girls varsity at that point. So here's, you know, there's more opportunity in high school. They could tell that that's going to be who your friend group is going to be with. And so, like my best friend in sixth grade, she played basketball. Her dad was a coach, and they're like, you should come play in a couple tournaments. And I did. And honestly, after that, I was, you know, full into basketball. And then I think, yeah, probably when I felt I could play college was probably after my sophomore year. We had a really good team, and I had a good season. So I just always played to have fun and all that. And then, yeah, midway through high school is when I was like, okay, I could play AU. You know, and then my parents were shuffling me all around to those tournaments, and then I started to get recruited. And so, but yeah, it was cool because right when I fell in love with the game right when I started playing. And then eventually I got to really like the NBA because we had just gotten the Timberwolves too in Minnesota. So we didn't have NBA before that. And so that was during the big Michael Jordan years and all that. So definitely became a fan after I switched over and started playing.
So your focus, I mean, you're doing basketball and track. Did you have a third sport or was that
kind
of taken? Tennis. Okay. Basketball, and track. So you've got, were you doing other activities in high school, or would you say that if anybody asked, like, who's Lindsay Whalen in high school, they would have said, Lindsay Whalen is a jock?
Yeah, she plays basketball because I would be at, like, every open gym I could get to, pretty much. Except in tennis, during the tennis season, I was pretty focused on that, but even still, I would find time to go play at open gym. Like, we had open gym Tuesdays and Thursday nights at the high school, Tuesdays and Fridays at the rec center. So I'd go play with the old guys, the high school guys, anybody that, you know, our girls team, you know, would play. So, I mean, yeah, I was just into playing against whoever. My coach was actually really cool. He, in the summers, he'd open up the gym from like 8 to noon and just pick teams, and we just play for hours. And so that was really cool. I played just a ton of basketball. And so, yeah, like I like tennis, but tennis was my kind of fun sport, you know, where it wasn't like I'm trying to play college. It was a lot of friends on the team. It was just more of a low key. I was still wanting to win, but it wasn't like my sport, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like the road trips were more fun, and, you know, all that stuff was a little more low key for me in tennis. And then I did track just because my friends were doing it. And one year I did AAU and track, and I ended up hurting my hip. And so the next year, I did that my freshman and sophomore year. And then I had to stop doing that my junior year. And I just focused on AAU basketball in the spring.
So you're kind of deciding that this could be a collegiate thing for you kind of coincided with the first year of the WNBA in 96. Was there a part of you that saw that and heard about that and said, that's a goal that I could achieve? Because we're around the same age. I'm just a little bit older than you. And that was never something that I saw right when it came out and immediately triggered for me, oh, you could go pro in this. It just took a little longer for me to get that was a thing. For you, was it pretty immediate?
Oh, no, same as you. I mean, it was like, it came out in 96, and I didn't really go to or watch any of the games until we got the links in 90. I think I was like 98, 99 when I was in like in high school. So me and my friends would drive to some games. We'd drive like the hour and a half in, and we'd go to like, I think I went to like 2 or 3 games, and then it was never a thought of mine in high school at all. And then I just, you know, we just like to go because it was like in the city. So you're driving yourself. It was just kind of more of an excuse to get out of Hutch and go to the city. And then probably, I would probably say after, again, after my sophomore year, junior year, yeah, maybe more so my junior year, I remember my coach, she had been the GM for the Liberty, our assistant coach, and she was talking to me about the WNBA, and I was just like, you think I could play in the WNBA? And she's like, if you keep working, if you keep, I mean, she knew I could, but she was just basically like, kept pushing me. And at that point, I was like, wow, I could, you know, really play, and I could play, you know, I never even thought that, like you said, in high school, like even my first couple years in college, like I was okay, but I wasn't great. And I never thought that there would be a possibility. And then I think Sue Bird came and did one, like she did some commentating when she was younger, and she came and interviewed me, and somebody was asking like who the next really great college guards are or were at the time, and my name was in that group that she mentioned, and I was just like floored, you know, that Sue Bird would say my name. It was like she was she would have been a rookie, she's probably like the rookie of the year in the WNBA, and I was still like I think a sophomore or junior. So now it's like I've played with and against her for 15 years, so it's like, you know, I know her and we're friends and it's cool. But at the time, I didn't know her. And just to hear Sue Bird say like, oh, yeah, she's going to definitely get drafted and she's one of the next great guards, I was just like, oh, man, I guess I really can, you know, if she said that. And then it made me work even harder and try to get that much better.
Tell me about University of Minnesota, because that's not a basketball powerhouse. And certainly when you got there, I was reading this crazy stat that the average attendance at women's hoops games your freshman season was just over 1,000. And it was almost 10,000 your senior year. What was it about, why University of Minnesota, or was it just that you weren't getting calls from the big powerhouses yet?
Yeah, I mean, I was recruited more like regionally right around here in Minnesota. So my teams, that the colleges that recruited me were Iowa, Wisconsin, North Dakota. I had some interest from Colorado for a while. I want to say like Cincinnati as well for a while. So, you know, a couple of Big Ten schools, but more like, you know, I guess one Big 12 or whatever, couple maybe Pac-10 schools, but not really any major schools, you know, not Tennessee, not UConn, not Georgia, all those schools. So, honestly, I was like, I'm a big homebody. So I was like, I wanted to stay home. I wanted to be near my parents. Right when I took my visit to Minneapolis or to University of Minnesota, I was like, that's where I want to be. I had several relatives in the Twin Cities, so they could come and like buy me groceries and stuff like that. So I was thinking this would be pretty cool. Like I'd be away, but still at home. And yeah, my first year was just, it was terrible. Honestly, like our coach was, she wasn't, it wasn't great. You know, we ran all the time. Everything was a punishment. Everybody was just kind of on edge all the time because you never knew when it was going to be like, get on the line. And I remember one time we lost Purdue by like 50. And like the next day in practice, she put 50 on the scoreboard, and we played against the guys' scout team for like 15 minutes. And if we like drew a charge, it was -2. If we got a stop, it was like -1. But if they scored, it was +. And however many was left on the scoreboard, that's how many sprints we had. Ooh. And it ended up being like 30 or something like that. And it was just like, days like that, you know, it's just like, what is going on? Like, this can't be it.
And you don't mind the work, right? It's just, it didn't feel like it was.
Yeah, like, we did one day we did practice, we started, and then she like, didn't like how it was going. We've been practicing for an hour, and she's like, start the clock over, we're starting over, like, let's re-huddle. And it's like, we're already exhausted, you know, and so.
Yeah.
It wasn't great. We won one Big Ten game. We were 8-20 that year. And then she got fired because it was just like our whole team basically came together and was like, we can't do this anymore. Like, this isn't how it should be. You know, it shouldn't be like this miserable. And then Brenda Freeze came in, and who's now at Maryland. And we went, it was just like a really liberating year for all of us. We went 22-8. And then in that year, the reason we went from that big of an attendance was because the other, we were in the smaller gym. And so, like you said, there was 1,000 people at our games my freshman year. And during my sophomore season, a water main broke and flooded the floor. So we had to go over to Williams, which holds 15,000. And so in that season when we're having all this success, we also moved arenas, and people were just like, all of a sudden it was just like this place to be. And these games were like, we were getting like 13,000 people at games. And we, before that, we, the most we ever had was like 2,000. So it was just like this crazy year. We ended up making the tournament, and then she left to go to Maryland. So she was there for 1 year. And then I had my third coach in 3 years, Pam Borton. Yeah, she was there my junior, senior year. And that's one thing too. I always tell kids now, pick, go for the school you want to go. Don't go for your coach, because they don't go for anything that could leave, you know, go for like,
yeah, for sure.
I really like the facilities. I really like them. The fact that they have this major. I like the fact that like, don't go for like, I mean, the coach is, yeah, the, you know, they're great, but hey, they can leave. And that happened to me 3 times. And so, but yeah, by my senior year, almost 10,000 people a game. It was pretty cool. It was a really fun to go from that adversity, which actually looking back on it now made my, the rest of my career special, but it was just tough to get that through that first year for sure. It was really interesting.
What did you study at Minnesota?
Sports management. So,
to what end? Like, what, were you, what were you interested in?
I guess at that point I was like wanting to be in like marketing or ticket sales for a team, or like be a GM, you know? And so that was kind of it. And it was more or less just, I don't know. I just needed something to like I needed something to declare, you know, I mean, who knows what I'll actually end up doing when I'm done playing, but it was more or less just something I needed to do and declare. And I'm glad I did. I learned a ton, and, you know, I had great teachers and really, a really fun group of, you know, classmates that you kind of go through in college when you kind of get to that major, that real specific, and you all have the same classes. It's pretty fun.
So you end up getting drafted, you start your pro career with the Connecticut Sun. What was it like to transition from being a collegiate player and sort of having this system that felt very, I mean, I think it's intimidating for us all to leave college and go off into the real world. Do you think it helped that you had the structure of joining another team and continuing that? Or was there a lot of learning curve there in becoming a pro?
Yeah, it was a lot. And I really am thankful that Mike Tebow, my first coach, was out there, because he had come from the NBA. And so he was on the Lakers coaching staff when they had Magic Johnson. And like, I think they won, he was on the staff when they won like 2 championships. And then he was with, he'd been in the NBA all these years, and then he was on, his last NBA job was with the Milwaukee Bucks when they made the Eastern Conference Finals. So with like Glenn Robinson and Ray Allen and those guys. So, so he really took the pro approach. So he was just great in like implementing, you know, how to take care of your body, your diet, your workouts, like, going game speed at every workout. And then he also likes freedom, you know, it's not college, and it's not like you have to figure out what routine works for you and how your game day routine works and how all that goes, because in college, it's all just set for you. And then in the pros, you have to figure it out, but you still have to be able to perform. So I was a rookie on that team. We had 5 rookies on that team. He was kind of revamping the roster, but I started with Katie Douglas, who was like 5 years older, Nikisha Sales, like 10 years older, Wendy Palmer and Taj were in their 30s. So, yeah, it was like I had to come in and kind of learn my way with like some pretty like strong-willed vets, which took some time for sure. We had our growing pains my first year, but in the end, we ended up making the championship, and we lost to Seattle in like a 3-game series, and it was tough. I mean, we had a chance to win in game 2, but it was tough to look back now after winning 4. It was like, that would have been nice to have 1 more, you know? So, but no, I give credit to Mike. It was tough leaving Minnesota a little, because that was the first time I'd ever been anywhere other than Minnesota. And so all of a sudden you're in Connecticut and you're playing your games at a casino, and I'm in Groton, Connecticut. I don't know. I'm sure you know about Connecticut, but I mean, it's a fairly small town, actually, after coming from Minneapolis too. I mean, it was kind of like, there was a couple of restaurants, and like we practiced at a Division III college. So it was a pretty big adjustment. And but you know, once you get into the season, once you get going, it's you know, it becomes like family, and it becomes a lot of fun.
So you spent 5 seasons there?
Six years.
So 6 years with the Sun. And you were also playing in Prague and Russia on the off seasons?
Yep.
How do you make that decision? Because I've heard from some big name players that they're not really interested in spending that off season time. And then of course there are, you know, the Tarassis of the world that are off every single season, and that's where they make a big bunch of their money is in that pro leagues overseas. So was it ever a decision for you not to maybe go there?
Yeah, first, and then I heard what they were going to pay me, so then it was pretty easy after that, because, I mean, as a rookie in the WNBA at that time, I think it was like $40,000, and then, you know, a team in Russia is going to offer you like a couple hundred thousand to go play, and it's just like, your jaw just kind of drops, and you're just like, oh my gosh, like, to go play basketball, they're going to pay me that much, and so it was like, after my first year, I came back and finished my degree, and I was also... no, my second year I was rehabbing an injury. So my first 2 years I didn't really go overseas. And then after my third year, so I was kind of like, I don't think I'm going to go. I don't think I'm going to be a player that goes overseas. And then one of my vets, Taj McWilliams Franklin, who I played with back here in Minnesota as well, she was on my team for my first 3 years. And I was telling her, I was like, I just don't think I'm going to go play overseas. And she's like, oh, you don't like money or something like that. You must not like money. And I was like, well, no, I like money. And she's like, okay, yeah, tell me that in like 5 years if you're not overseas. And so that year, after my third year in the league, my agent called and was like, this team in Russia wants you, a player's leaving. You know, will you go? And when he said how much it was, I was like, yes, I was in Russia in 6 days. So it was a pretty easy decision.
I mean, it's easy to say yes to the money and to know that you're going out there to do something that you love and that you know, which is basketball. But there's a language barrier. There's a culture barrier. You're by yourself in the middle of nowhere that you don't understand and recognize, and you've got to work with new teammates and coaches that maybe, you know, operate differently. What was that like?
Oh, yeah. My first year, I had no idea what I was doing. Honestly, I was like, I'm surprised they didn't kick me off the team in a month. Just not anything bad, but just like, it's a totally different style of play. You have to understand that you're on like their team, you know, like I'm on this Rush team with a bunch of Russian girls, and the coach is actually from Czech Republic, but just their mindset is different. And you come in, you kind of think you know everything, and it's just like, there's a totally different way to play and different mindset and different like workouts and different approaches to things over there. And it's back to more like over there, it's back to more college, where it's just like team meal at noon. Like, the bus leaves here or there. It's just, like, really controlled over there. And that was a big adjustment. So my first year, yeah, we struggled for sure my first year. And we had big expectations. We were on one of the best teams in Russia. So we had big expectations, and we didn't fulfill them. And so, like, our coach got let go midway through the season. And then I think one player got re-signed. The rest of us were just out the next year. But it was a good learning experience, because I learned a lot on like how to adjust and how to, like you said, like how to, you know, be able to manage in different cultures. And so then the next year when I went to Prague, I was like so much more just like open and accepting and like, okay, yeah, this is how they do it. And this is how I have to be. And this is what I have to do, especially as a point guard too. Cause when you're on the floor, you're the coach, you know, you're the leader. And now it's like, yeah, you know, the language barrier, and you have to learn that, you know, sometimes the mentality of your teammates over there are different. They're not all WNBA players. And so you have to play with people that, you know, don't quite have that, you know, same, I guess, you know, skill and drive, you know, at certain points, to be honest. And so, but you can still find their positives, and you can still make them, you know, as a point guard, you can still, you know, figure out their strengths. And so that's why I was in Prague for 5 years, because like I got along with them. My mentality was, you know, pretty laid back, and I understood what they needed, you know, somebody to do. And so it was, that was a pretty easy one to keep going back. We basically had an apartment over there in Prague for like 5 years. We just kept like all of our winter stuff over there. And then I had all of our summer stuff in the States. So
we being you and your husband,
it's pretty cool. What's that?
we being you and your husband, he was out there with
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yep.
So he was a golfer in Minnesota, and in those first couple years of your pro career, he was traveling with you wherever you were?
He would, yeah, in the winter, so he'd come over with me to, like, Prague, Russia. Russia, he was only there for a little bit because he was really still trying to make, like, Q school. So he was in Phoenix training my first year in Russia. And then during that time, he was kind of like, should I keep playing? Should I not? Should I start working? And so he would, the off season, like our winter season over there, he would come over and he'd be there with me in Prague, I think most of those first 2 years. And then as he got working more in his career, he would be traveling like back and forth more and more each year. But those first couple of years, yeah, we were just like in Prague. We like came home once for Christmas and it was like for 5 days. So we were there for like 7-8 months. So like he had a gym membership to go work out. He had, we like knew all the people at the restaurants by our house and like the little corner store. So we really got immersed into the Prague would probably be where we got, you know, the most comfortable and we were like, felt like we were just kind of, you know, living them, you know, as most of a normal life as you can have over there.
Yeah, it's cool that you got to bring him because as you're adjusting, you at least have, you know, something that feels like home. And also it makes it more fun to explore on the off days to have, you know, your husband with you. You know, I've
Absolutely.
Asked a couple people this and no one has had the answer. What do you think the real reason is that women athletes, particularly basketball, are able to go abroad and make that kind of money and the system doesn't work that way here?
Well, because for one, there's no salary cap. And so over there too, you know, here at WNBA, all these, you know, structures, I think baseball doesn't, but everybody pretty much has a salary cap, right? And so, you know, the owners, you know, there's a CBA, there's collective bargaining, whereas over there, there's not. There's just like, you know, the owners in Russia are just like competing with each other and they're billionaires. They're either in oil or they're in, you know, some company and they just are like, this is my hobby. I want to have the best women's basketball team in Russia. And they pay whatever they need, feel like they need to pay to get the best players. Or
and they don't do that with the men or they do that with the men as well.
Same. Yeah. Same. Same with the men.
Because it's like here, I think we obviously have billionaire owners, but they're usually buying the men's teams here. And that becomes their side project.
And then here it just becomes more of like, definitely, and then here it's revenue-based. Where there, it's like, this guy doesn't care if he makes money off the team. He just wants to brag that he has the best team. Or
so it's
I
cultural.
Played on some teams too where, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, where we're like, okay, we get this amount of dollars from ticket sales, we get this amount of dollars from TV sales, we get this amount of dollars from corporate sponsors, da-da-da-da, okay, this is what we can pay for salaries. You know, which is, I mean, it makes sense, right? We're over there. It's just different culture. Like you said, it's a different mindset, different culture. You might have a guy who's like, hey, yeah, I'm worth, you know, he might have, I don't know, $50 billion or something. He's like, so, you know, a $10 million salary cap, or I mean, budget for his women's basketball team is like nothing. And so it's just like, that's what he does. And so we all kind of came along this time where women's basketball is becoming more popular around the world. And so if some of these owners too, there's, you know, maybe there's a place that's not going to have a men's team like Ekaterinburg or, you know, there's so many organizations and people in Moscow that, you know, there's like 5 men's teams. Well, there's also 5 women's teams just because there's so many people there and they wanted to have a, you know, a team. And I also was on a team in Turkey where it was part of the government, honestly, and the government paid our salaries because they wanted to have this team as a pride of the city. And so it'd be like, you know, it's just, yeah, it was like more of a municipal thing on different teams I've been on too. So
yeah,
that's the best way I can explain it. It's not revenue based as it is here for all of our sports.
Well, and you mentioned you know the cap space and all that. And when Elena Deladon left the Sky to go to the Mystics, one of the things that I learned that I didn't know about WNBA contracts is that there's essentially something that's similar to a franchise tag. So even though she became a restricted free agent when her rookie contract expired, Chicago technically could have the leverage to keep her using the designated core player. So that's like the franchise tag.
Yep.
So like they could have applied that to her multiple times to the point where she would essentially not have true unrestricted free agency until she was 33 years old. When you are talking to, I don't know if you're involved at all in the WNBA, like, is there a players association for the WNBA?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We actually, we just had a call. We have like monthly calls on it, and yeah, there's definitely a WNBA PA. I think it's been, I want to say for, 20 years. So I think it, I'm pretty sure
shortly
for a year or two
they're
operated without one, but yeah,
I mean,
now we have one.
It seems impossible not to have one, but I'm also curious as to how there was a negotiation that allowed that, because Deladon's the second huge star from the sky to force her way out, to literally just say, I'd rather sit. And that happened with Sylvia Fowles as well. So it's super disappointing for Chicago Sky fans to first say, okay, what's happening with the Sky that everyone wants to leave? And secondarily, you understand when you look at this, like, why would the Players Association agree to something that would prevent a player from having any agency until all the way up to 33 years old?
Well, I think that there's always been this, the mindset that, okay, in order to have these franchises survive and in order to have the league survive, we need to have our best players stay in the same city so the same fans keep coming back. And so there hasn't been, there's really not much player movement at all. I mean, later on in your career, as you said, you get to the point where there are some like unrestricted free agents and there's, you know, usually, you know, a pretty solid group each season, but those are, you know, the older players, the vet players, or maybe somebody was like cut and then went over to Europe and got a lot better and now they're back. So then they're unrestricted, that type of thing. But it's really, it's not that often. And I think that's somewhere where the league is hopefully growing to, is to have more of that movement and have more player freedom in that situation. Cause yeah, when you get drafted to a team, I mean, like you said, you're right. Cause it's 11, I think it's 11 seasons where, or however many, it's something like that, where it's like, you really, unless you ask for a trade, you have no say really on where you're going to go. And so hopefully you like the city and your coach because you have no freedom. You have no freedom of movement. And that's just, that's the way it is. And I think that's the way that at the beginning, the league and the Players Association agreed that, okay, this is what we should do. This is in order to, you know, grow the game, grow the fan bases, you know, I'm sure many more reasons, but yeah, I think that's something where hopefully, you know, in the next, whenever the next agreement is, that that'll be something that will be addressed. And just because, as you said, I think that that makes it, obviously the NBA makes it really interesting. Where's this player going to go? There's more chatter, all that.
Well, and so, recently, especially that's been such a huge bump for the NBA, right? So I understand the initial concept for the WNBA of wanting to keep these stars and maintain. But it feels to me like there's often this trade-off in women's sports of sacrificing the individual for the greater good. And in a lot of ways, it's admirable, and it does make the stars of women's sports kind of fulfill what we think and say we want from our athletes, which is to work hard, to do your best, to be a good teammate, to be good in the community. And I agree with all that. I think that's that so many of our women's stars embody that. But there is still this idea that then you have to represent everything for everyone. And you have to put the good of building a league ahead of yourself. And that's also, I would think, tough to shoulder sometimes.
Yeah, and I mean, this is, you know, something that I've learned throughout my career, too. And it's been, you know, for me personally, learning to have to like ask for money to go for to appearances, you know, and like you get paid, you know, the WNBA will pay you to go to an appearance or whatever. But I mean, at one point, you know, just in your off season, people ask you, will you just run around and do everything every day because they ask you to, and you feel like you've been brought up, you feel like that's the right thing to do. But it's like, hey, like if I'm going to go do this, I should be like compensated this way, you know? And so I think it definitely goes hand in hand. I think we're entering hopefully a new era where, like you said, there is the greater good. And yes, we want to have, you know, strong teams and a good league. But, you know, if you're, everybody's put a lot of time and a lot of hard work into all this too. And so you want to feel like you're being benefited as well or compensated or whatever it is. So it's definitely a learning experience. And I think I started when I was in the league, it was around, it was like it's seventh year. Now it's in its 22nd year. So, I mean, hopefully that next, you know, 20 years or whatever, we'll start to see, you know, like you said, a lot more player movement and higher salaries and all those things for the players and higher league revenue. Everybody, then everybody wins, you know, and it's just, it's both sides need to keep working hard and keep growing the game.
Yeah, you know, I think it's so hard to look at women's sports and try to judge them on a timeline that doesn't, you know, reflect the fact that all these other men's teams have been around forever. So people have nostalgia. They grew up with them and they got through their kinks so long ago. And so, there's time that's needed to invest and to adjust and to become fans of these leagues. I wonder when you're one of the most successful WNBA players of all time. As you just mentioned, you've been playing it longer than it's existed, you know, like as long or longer. And you're on a team that's had a great deal of success. When we were in Minnesota, Minneapolis, walking around doing Super Bowl stuff, everywhere we went, mostly men, but women too, were coming up to you. Oh my God, I'm a huge fan. Can I get a photo with you? You guys have brought 4 championships to Minnesota while most of the other Minnesota teams can't get it together. So you are a model franchise. You get big fan support. You get good attendance. You won a bunch of titles. Does it feel like where you are, at least in your bubble, the WNBA has taken these great strides since you started?
Yeah, for our team, for sure. I mean, I think we've seen just what winning does and not just winning, but like we have good people. You know, you have Maya, our coach. People are out there in the community doing really good things. Rebecca Brunson. So there, it goes hand in hand. But yeah, I mean, the bottom line is we win, and so people want to come see us play LA. They want to come see us play Phoenix, the other franchises that have won and been successful. And so, yeah, I mean, I feel like for my first year here with the Lynx, my 7th year overall. I mean, I would say we've quadrupled attendance or something like that. I mean, compared to those first couple games, it's been really good. And I mean, when I was in Connecticut too, we went to the finals 2 years in a row right off the bat, and then we went to the conference finals. And so we had great attendance out there too. So I've always played really good, supportive fan bases. And so I've been lucky. I've been really lucky. I think, I think Seattle, they draw as well, but they've won 2 championships in Phoenix, LA. So it's about, it's like everything with sports. It's about, winning and the product you have on the floor. And so I think that's what you see now with our teams and the really successful ones. We have some good rivalries too. So I would say from what I've seen here in Minnesota, yeah, it's been cool. I mean, we're mentioned with the men's sports teams here, and you probably can't say that about everywhere, hopefully someday, but I mean, we're definitely, if you go click on our local newspaper website, the Lynx is right there with the Timberwolves and the Wild or the Vikings,
and which that's is, like, and the same not thing. Even a lot to ask, and yet it is surprising in so many places. Yeah.
And it is, because if you go to the other, or if you go or watch a newscast somewhere else, like our newscast, like when they talk about the sports, our logo is always up there. And like you say, it shouldn't be like this big deal, but it is. And it is here because, they do think of that, and they have done well because we've won. I don't think they were doing that before all these championships.
People love a winner, so, for sure. Yeah.
People love a winner. So you got to win. And then you got to also have, people who are making decisions and doing all that be, open-minded and forward thinking as well.
Yeah. I want to ask about, you win the title, and well, before we even get there, when did you find out that Prince was a fan of the Lynx?
Oh man, I guess probably that night.
Really? So it hadn't been something where I don't even know if Prince could come to a game. He'd have to have Obama type security, especially in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
But so you hadn't really heard that he was a fan before that.
No, and Prince was an interesting guy. He kind of just laid low. I mean, I feel like, but then you'd hear about him at Walgreens or something like that. So it's just like, but I don't know. It was cool. He lived in Minnesota, and he obviously was an amazing artist, but he had his huge compound out in Chanhassen. So in a suburb, and I don't know, he was just kind of out there, and it's like this massive, massive place. It's also a studio and the place we ended up going to was
the famed Paisley Park
hall.
That we've all heard so much about.
Yeah,
and
Paisley
you've
Park.
Gotten to, be in on. So yeah, so that gets me to here. So you guys win. This was not your most recent. This was the 2015 title.
15. 2015 title.
So the 2015 title, and you're in the locker room, you're celebrating, drinking champagne, everyone's fired up. It's your third title in a couple years, and then somebody gets the call. So take us from there.
Yeah, so our GM, Roger Griffith, comes in. It's just like, hey, we're going, you know, all your friends and family can come to Seven, the steakhouse across the street. We're going to have a little Lynx party there, and then we're going out to Paisley Park for a concert that Prince is going to put on. And then the place just went nuts. Like, you know, there were even like the reporters were just like, what? Like, that's crazy. It was, yeah, it was just, it kind of took the party to another level. And so, yeah, we went over and went to 7-8, had some drinks over there. Then we took out like a couple like limo buses to Paisley Park, and we had to like leave our phones, no alcohol, and just, which was cool because, you know, I mean, it was just about like the music, and we, you just walked by Prince. And so all of a sudden he's sitting there, not sitting, but he's on the keyboard as we're walking in. And that was pretty special. I mean, he had the Lynx, the logo across his like big screen or whatever in the place. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess he was at the game, which was awesome. And he was at the game, and, yeah, I don't know. It was definitely a special night, that's for sure.
So he's an interesting cat, though, because like you mentioned, like he's got the Lynx logo up. He's at your game. He's a fan. He's fired up. He performs a concert for you, but he doesn't hang out. Like, he's not down to like chit chat, right? He's just, I'm going to put this party on. I'm going to be surrounded by you, feeling the aura of your greatness and how you guys are champions yet again. But I don't want to interact because I'm weird and I'm Prince.
Yeah, and then he ended up, like, riding his bike around the parking lot, but, like, he just, like, at 5 a.m., I guess. I left because I sprained my ankle in that game, so I was like, I got to get home, but...
What?
People were like, yeah.
You left early from Prince's house?
Yeah, my ankle, I know. I was tired, and my ankle was super jacked up. I was, like, really unhealthy that year. I had an Achilles strain. I barely made it through the playoffs that year, and then I sprained my ankle in game 5. And so... I left at like 3.
All right. You were partying hard. I'll give it to you.
I was partying hard, but I wasn't like the last bus to leave. You know, like I was on like, hey, what time do you, you know, I'm like, it's 2:45. I think I'll head home. I mean, this is amazing. But people who stayed up and were like, they're like, yeah, all of a sudden he came down on this bike and started riding around the parking lot on this bike at like 5 a.m. and like, didn't speak to anybody, had his sunglasses on, and just was riding around on in the thing and as they were waiting for the bus. So
that's great.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. But yeah, like he had a certain style, like no phones, no alcohol. Mm-hmm. So it's like he had to have things a certain way. He was kind of he was definitely quirky, that's for sure.
And you guys are cool with that because you're at Prince's house. So you're like, yeah, whatever you say, man. We're down. We're fine with that. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I probably would have liked to bring a bottle of champagne in with me, but
keep the champagne going. Right.
Yeah, I get why he doesn't want, you know, he doesn't want it to get like crazy in there. So, I mean,
interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So, you're 35. You are still, you know, playing at a big clip. Your minutes are a little down. You've got, you know, you're trading a little bit more time than you used to be, but you're clearly still a massive leader on this team, and you guys are coming off a 2017 title. So, what's next for you? How long do you think you're going to play? And then after that, how are you going to transition into having to be just a real world schlub like the rest of us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've gone back and forth this year a lot because, like you said, we won our fourth. And it's just like, where can you kind of go? And it's getting to that point where, you know, the end is closer than in the beginning, obviously. But then you watch like a Tom Brady video and you see he's still doing it at 41 and you're like, oh, maybe I can, you know, keep this thing going and play as long as I can. So, you know, at this point, it's like, you know, I think one of our big goals, you know, we have 4 championships now. The Comets team had 4. So it's like we want to obviously pass them. So I think that's one of our big goals is to try to get one more. But at this point it's like, you know, I'm in it for, you know, my teammates and the competition and playing and, kind of accomplished a lot of the goals along the way. It's been great. So now it's just, and it's a big thing is health and nutrition and working out and doing all those things. And, it's all those things. So it's like, you really have to pay attention even more to those little things that you could get away with even at 30, now at 35 that you can't, and you have to take things you know, that much more, you know, seriously as far as like, you know, what are you eating and getting your sleep and making sure you're hydrated and all those things. So like me and my trainer say, what would Tom Brady do? Because it's like, would he eat that? Would he, you know, would he stay out late? He probably not. He's probably, you know, in there watching video and like, you know, eating spinach and getting ready for the next day.
And so I really screwed you up on that trip. We ate some we ate some cheese curds. We ate cheeseburgers. I mean, we did it up.
Yeah, we did it up. That was actually my last, because I just started work with my trainer right around that time. So that was like my last hurrah, honestly. So,
nice. Gave you a good
cheat day,
man.
It was a good way to go out.
Feel good about that. Yeah, exactly. But, speaking of going out, before I let you go, you got to do the one thing that everybody does.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right. Nobody expects it. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Oh, a natural talent?
Yep.
Oh, man. Being able to, like, just have better handwriting and being able to, like, draw or paint.
Okay,
I'm like a disaster.
A little bit more artistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, my husband's handwriting is like a 3-year-old. I'm like, I don't know how anybody reads this. And it gets worse the more we use computers because we just write even less. So it gets worse and worse. Number two, your desert island album. You can only have one.
Ooh. I would say The Outcast, Aquemini.
Nice. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
I would say Khloe Kardashian. I'm watching Kardashians right now.
Really? A Kardashian? I would not have pictured you to be a Kardashian fan.
No, I'm just I want a private plane. I want to make enough money for this private plane because then you can just go wherever. So I'm like, man, that's what I got to do.
You're just watching someone
hard.
Really rich and you're like that.
Yeah, I'm like, that would be fun. Like,
yeah, and just, she's the funny one at least. If you're going to be a Kardashian.
Yeah, and, like, she works out hard, and she, like, is obviously, I mean, I don't know, she dates basketball players, so she's obviously a basketball fan, so,
there
I mean.
Of all the Kardashians, I would pick Khloe, too. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oh, man, I was in a plane going to the conference semifinals, I think, in my fourth year, and I honestly thought we were going down.
Oof.
And we were going, it was like in the fall, so and there was like severe weather in Indianapolis, and we were landing, and it was just like, I mean, the guy next to me who I'd never met, we were saying Our Father together, like holding each other's hands. It was horrendous.
Yikes.
And I was like sore the next day from tensing up in this plane, and so I still get scared sometimes with turbulence, but I'm like, as long as I never have to go through that again, I'll be fine when I fly.
Oof. Number five, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Oh, man.
You've won pretty much everything, so.
Yeah, I would say. One of my biggest regrets, it wasn't really we didn't win. I would say not beating UConn my senior year.
Yeah.
They beat us to go to the finals, and I think we would have, I feel like we would have beat Tennessee that year. I mean, I thought. Our game was the championship game, in my opinion. I feel like we would have beat Tennessee. So I feel like, and I feel like we were neck and neck with UConn and just, I mean, Diana was there. So obviously she's like, you know, greatest of all time, but I still feel like we could have beat them if we would have just, I don't know. We made some really bad mistakes down the stretch of that game. And so I look back on that game as like that one or one of my first two WNBA championships we didn't win. Those were some big, big letdowns. Yeah.
Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
I would say like being a good teammate, and like, yeah, just doing the little things like being on time and being a good person.
Do you think every teammate you've ever had would say you're a good teammate?
Yeah, I would say most of them. I would say most
really?
Would say
there's
that.
Not that one person that just popped into your head.
Yeah, I'm thinking like there's definitely somebody along the line that was like, nah. Like she's full of it. Like she's full
probably
of it. Like
she's got every minute.
She's got everybody fooled, man. She's got everybody fooled. Because you're not gonna go along with everybody, but
that's true.
I would say that's probably been I mean, it's one of the reasons why I made the Olympic team is because they're not going to, you know, like, if you're going to be on that team, not only do you have to be really good, but you have to be, like, easy to be around and a good teammate, because it's just, like, they don't have time for any, like, you know, drama and all this and that. So, I mean, it helped me out there for sure.
What's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Oh, man. My VO2 max, my conditioning. My
really?
Like yeah, I'd like to be like 10 pounds lighter and like really back to what I was like when I was like 28 quick. So I'm working on it, but like if I could just snap my fingers and make that happen, that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
For this season.
Nice.
Yeah. Yep.
What three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Three words?
Mm-hmm.
Loyal, funny, and what is it? On time, prompt. I'm on time.
Prompt. Loyal,
yeah,
funny,
prompt.
And prompt.
Mm, yep, I'm on time. If you tell me time to be there, I'm going to be there 15
That's
minutes.
A good
before.
Quality. That is a very
yep.
good quality.
Try
it's
to.
A good quality, especially if you're hanging out with me, because I'm pretty much always on time, and I also get like ulcers when I make people wait. So if I'm with
yeah,
people that make me late, then I sit there and I stew because I feel like so bad that I'm late for other people or yeah, yeah. So that's a good quality to have. And
yeah,
then
man.
Finally, who would you recommend that I have here on my podcast next? Who's a good person to talk to?
I'd say my coach, Cheryl Reeves. She'll tell you what she's thinking. If you want to talk about like women's sports and growing the game and like getting more women's sports on like TV, yeah, she'd be good. She's been on like going on some. She's had some interesting, some good discussions and back and forth with you know, different people in the media on things, and she's not afraid, and she'll tell you what she thinks. So she'd definitely be good. Cheryl Reeves.
Awesome.
Final answer.
Hey,
yeah,
thanks so much for making time for me. Awesome. Awesome chatting with you. I look forward to putting this out there and watching the Lynx fans dive on it because everybody was calling for it. So thanks
Sweet.
For talking to me.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and another thing.
Today's That's What She Read is from teenvogue.com, and they have actually been doing a really, really great job of covering some of the biggest news of the day for the last year plus, and maybe before that, although they haven't really been on my radar till I read that great piece by Lauren Duca about gaslighting. And that kind of, I think, drew a lot of people's attention to the work that Teen Vogue is doing to talk about kind of bigger issues than one might expect for their publication. And the story I came across today from a little earlier this week is the headline is Black Teens Have Been Fighting for Gun Reform for Years. Teens' recent fight for gun control is awesome and inspiring, but don't forget that it's exactly what young black activists have been doing. And it's a really interesting story about how it is incredible and powerful and important and positive that the students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School have been given a platform and have been, for the most part, with some exceptions, unfortunate exceptions, but for the most part, been treated with respect and been listened to and been heard and been congratulated for their stance on really important issues that affect them. I mean, this has been, if you're a high school student right now, you have been alive throughout the entirety of our school shooting conflict and our school shooting epidemic. And so it's something you've been hearing about and talking about and debating your whole life. And so they are uniquely qualified to speak on it, and they are qualified to be heard. But while we're doing this, we need to also think about black youth who have been advocating for gun control measures and who have been protesting and fighting for gun reform laws for years without a lot of the support and the energy and the positivity that's being shined upon the kids from Stoneman Douglas. It's not to say one or the other. It's both. And we can give both the respect that they deserve. And you know, in the story they talk about, it says here, young black activists have been in the streets advocating for gun reform for decades without much attention or mass appeal. But that doesn't mean they don't exist or that they work without leadership or that their demands are unclear. While we celebrate the success of the Stoneman Douglas teens, it's crucial to examine which progressive movements are embraced and legitimized, considered worthy of a passionate public response and united steely resolve, and which are received with skepticism, restraint, and apprehension, and why that might be. It's a really good read, and it's a really good thing to think about as we continue to figure out where we give our support and our positivity and whose voices we want to elevate. So it's in teenvogue.com. It's by Lincoln Anthony Blades. Black teens have been fighting for gun reform for years is the headline. So check it out. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.